Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, is the arrest of Saddam Hussein having a big impact on politics in Israel on the eve of an important speech by Ariel Sharon? Observers wonder if the war in Iraq changes the landscape for peace in the Middle East.
Also, does he have the right to be silent? We'll find out how Saddam Hussein is being interrogated.
And the anniversary of the flight that made the Wright brothers rich and famous. Well, famous anyway.
The same personality traits that made them able to be successful in inventing the airplane were the same traits that worked against them in their efforts to market it and to do anything with it.
These stories and gourmet food online coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Bush visited North Carolina for the 100th anniversary of the Wright brothers' flight demonstration today. Mr. Bush says the Wrights faced down skepticism to record their stunning achievement.
That little wood and canvas aircraft had brought together all the essentials that still give flight to every modern aircraft, from a single prop plane to Air Force One.
Heavy rain scuttled a morning attempt to recreate the Wright brothers' flight at Kill Devil Hills. Interpreters and historians will try again this afternoon. At least 10 people were killed today in Iraq when a speeding truck crashed into a bus and exploded at a Baghdad intersection. More than 20 others were hurt in the blast. The BBC's James Rogers in Baghdad reports Iraqi police believe the truck was headed for a police station when it crashed.
Police believe that they were going to be the target of a suicide bombing. We've seen similar attacks in recent days, the most deadly of them on Sunday, when a police station west of Baghdad was attacked by a suicide bomb. 17 people killed on that occasion, and the police seem increasingly to be bearing the brunt of the insurgents' attacks.
The BBC's James Rogers in the Iraqi capital. Jurors hearing the murder case against accused sniper suspect Lee Boyd Malvo continue to deliberate. They're weighing whether the teenager was brainwashed by convicted sniper John Allen Muhammad, or, as prosecutors allege, Malvo was an active participant in the shootings and knew clearly what he was doing. Malvo was being tried for one slaying out of the 10, that of FBI analyst Linda Franklin. Students in some of the nation's largest urban school districts scored below the national average on federal math and reading tests, according to results released today. But minority students in some districts competed well against their national peers of the same race, ethnicity, or economic level. NPR's Paul Brown has details.
The report from the National Assessment of Educational Progress shows that fourth and eighth graders from 10 large urban districts scored below the national average on federal math and reading tests. The urban districts had higher percentages of minority students than suburban and rural districts, supporting earlier evidence of a continuing achievement gap between minorities and whites. But in Charlotte, North Carolina, where there's been an effort to enroll minorities in high-level courses, students met the national average in reading and exceeded it in math. Ross Weiner of the Education Trust said this shows educational policies at the district level can be very important in helping minority students achieve. Education Secretary Rod Page responded to the report, saying the nation must stand united against what he called a culture that mocks academic success in certain communities. Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down 14 points at 10,115. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission says the top job at the New York Stock Exchange will now be divided into two. SEC Chairman William Donaldson says the jobs will be CEO and, separately, chairman. He says the stock exchange will be better protected from having too much authority vested in one person. A federal judge has allowed a California firm to continue sending pop-up ads. The Federal Trade Commission is suing D Squared for allegedly sending a barrage of pop-up ads promoting software that can stop the ads. Jason Lopez reports from San Francisco.
The FTC lost part of its battle to muzzle D Squared until a trial begins in March. The judge said there wasn't enough evidence to warrant shutting the firm down and ruled its pop-up ads didn't harm computer users. D Squared uses an obscure feature in Microsoft software called Windows Messenger. It allows tech administrators to send messages which show up on web-connected computers even if the internet browser is not on. The FTC says D Squared practiced a form of extortion by sending a flurry of pop-up ads, offering software which would stop the ads. But the company argues the practice is not illegal. Microsoft has posted on its website instructions on how to shut off the Messenger feature. For NPR News, I'm Jason Lopez in San Francisco.
Some members of Congress want to know why natural gas costs are going up. Utah Senator Orrin Hatch says the Judiciary Committee he heads will hold hearings. Heavy use of natural gas is expected at this time of year as more people heat their homes. But the Energy Department says natural gas supplies are slightly above the average level on hand for the winter season. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
The NPR shop features an assortment of clothing, mugs, and other NPR gear selected especially for public radio listeners at npr.org.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
There is great anticipation in Israel today ahead of Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's address tomorrow before a conference on security. Will he or won't he offer a sweeping new plan to achieve a peaceful settlement with the Palestinian people? Last week, Israel's deputy prime minister, a fierce hawk and friend of Sharon, caused a political earthquake by suggesting that Israel dismantle some settlements and unilaterally withdraw from large swaths of Palestinian territory to force the peace process to move ahead. A spokesperson for Sharon would not say whether the speech would meet public expectation or be business as usual, but told Here and Now, stay tuned. We're joined on the line from Tel Aviv by Alon Ben-David. He's security correspondent for Israel's Channel 10 TV and a frequent guest on Here and Now. Welcome, Alon.
Thank you very much, Robin.
As you're well aware, Prime Minister Sharon is due to speak tomorrow night at the closing of this annual security conference. It's called the Herzliya Conference. Have we exaggerated the anticipation?
Well, you're not alone if you have, because everybody is anticipating an earth-shattering speech, and I think we can only be disappointed. There's been a lot of build-up for that speech. Everybody's expecting, and look what's going on within the Likud party. I mean, all the ministers of the Likud following the Deputy Prime Minister Ehud Olmert is suddenly speaking about unilateral acts which were unspeakable 2 or 3 weeks ago. So probably what we are watching is the starting gun of the internal debate within the Likud for replacing Sharon. And everybody who considers himself a candidate is trying to align with this new spirit of unilateral concessions, of unilateral moves by Israel, which were really unthinkable a few weeks ago.
Well, and many people are saying that the reason that Olmert's comments were so important is that he was seen as perhaps maybe preparing the ground for Sharon to at least move closer to this kind of talk. You don't see it that way?
Could be, but others would say that Olmert is preparing his own ground to compete, maybe against Sharon, maybe against Netanyahu. On leading the Likud, I think that all of them, Sharon and his other ministers, are sensing the great anticipation within the Israeli public to see some kind of change. Now, all of them believe that there's no partner on the other side, there's no one to negotiate with on the Palestinian side, and that is why they're beginning to speak about unilateral acts. We've seen Limor Livnat, the Minister of Education, which is also a very right-wing hawk, speaking again also on unilateral acts. Even the defense minister, another hawk, Shaul Mofaz, is talking about places which are more important to us and places that we can spare. So I think all of them are sensing that the Israeli public is thirsty for some kind of hope.
Well, Alon, let me ask you, what about the arrest of Saddam Hussein and the war in Iraq in general? Columnist Tom Friedman here in the States writes that the biggest fallout from that war
has been on Israel, which has long argued, or at least Sharon has, for instance, that it needed to keep the West Bank as a buffer against an attack from Iraq. Now it would seem that that threat would be gone. Are some of these politicians seen as perhaps reacting to that?
True, and strategically, Thomas Friedman's analysis is very accurate. But I think that the result of what's going on in Iraq, and especially of the continuous conflict there, is that the United States government would like to keep things calm here in the Middle East. So I don't think they are reacting to foreseeing an American pressure coming here, but more postponing this pressure. Sharon has been releasing all these test balloons in the last few weeks. He's been talking about the occupation, how it's bad for Israel, about evacuating some settlements, but he hasn't presented any real crystallized policy in that sense. He's just been saying all these phrases, and the press and the public, because it's Sharon and because he has such a hawkish image, are dealing with these declarations, but he's not present any real policy solution. And we haven't heard any until now. I'm afraid we won't be hearing any tomorrow either.
And in fact, the new threat looms, which is the possibility that, as Overt said, the bigger problem now will be the loss of the Jewish majority.
That is very right. I don't know if you heard Netanyahu's speech today, but it was quite blunt, and he spoke about something that is almost a taboo here, which I think is going to change soon. He spoke about the Arab population within Israel, which is growing in significant numbers and has a very large growth rate compared to the Jewish population. That is something no one dares to touch until today, and he spoke about it publicly today.
Saying what, Alon? Saying what? That unless there was a two-state solution, it would only become worse, I'm imagining?
No, but saying also that the demographic problem of Israel is not only with the occupied territories, but within Israel itself, because of the growing Arab population within Israel. I'm talking about the Israeli Arab citizens. Mm. And this is something really nobody dared to touch before today. This is a taboo here. Nobody.
And the solution is what?
Well, he's not saying it, but I think many people here think that if we're going to draw the line, in some places it should be west to the Green Line. That means parts of 1967 Israel should be incorporated within the Palestinian state.
In other words, that bolsters the Jewish majority in an Israeli state and keeps the Arab population in a Palestinian state.
Yeah, drawing the line according to demographics and putting the line where Arabs on one side and Jews on the other. Mm. This is going to steer a huge debate here, but it's going to be a major issue here because the numbers are troubling.
Well, as we said at the beginning, we will stay tuned. Alon, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Alon Ben-David, security correspondent for Israel's Channel 10 television.
Well, now the latest on the arrest of Saddam Hussein. How are U.S. interrogators doing getting him to open up? John Diamond covers intelligence for USA Today. Welcome, John.
Good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, John, as you know, describes Saddam at this point as resigned. Well, he's in prison for the rest of his life. Most believe he's likely headed for execution. What techniques, John, will be used to get a man with nothing to lose to tell the truth?
It's going to be a slow process. There's a lot of material to cover, and there's multiple agendas. There's the agenda of prosecuting him in a war crime trial, and there's the agenda of getting as much intelligence from him as possible about what's going on in Iraq now with the insurgency, about what's gone on in the past in terms of U.S. conflict with Iraq, about weapons of mass destruction, and about dealings that Iraq may have had with other countries regarding buying or selling weapons of mass destruction.
But any reluctant witness that you're interrogating, you have to seduce somehow. And what possibly do we have in our arsenal, does the CIA have in its arsenal, to induce Saddam Hussein to tell us anything that's true?
In one sense, the fact that Saddam probably has nothing to lose is a help because there's no real incentive for him to lie at this point.
Except his ego and
his
rage.
The interrogators, though, are going to try to play on that ego, to try to press him in ways that will make his ego kick in and get him talking, get him boasting.
What will they do, John?
Well, one of the things they're already doing is showing him videotapes, showing anti-Saddam protests in Iraq to undercut his notion as the great leader beloved by his own people. They are showing him videotapes of the mass graves they've unearthed, of summary executions, to give a sense of the strength of the evidence against him. Mm. They're going to try to provoke him, perhaps, into unguarded comments. They're going to try to make it clear that they know what he did, leaving the only issue for him to provide an explanation. They are also going to use the common technique of asking questions they already know the answers to.
Control questions, they
call
it.
Control questions to see if he's being truthful. They can be rather subtle about that because they may know quite a bit more than he believes they know. So there's a number of techniques, but I think the most important technique will be time. And the experience that interrogators have had with other senior Iraqi captives is that perhaps in the very beginning, not much of value comes out. But as more time goes by, they get bored, they get tired of bobbing and weaving, and suddenly the flow starts and helpful information comes out. There are some indications they already are getting some valuable information.
John, he won't be tortured, will he?
He will not. There are very detailed rules of engagement, do's and don'ts as to interrogation. What those rules are remains classified so that future subjects of interrogation don't have a pre-brief, if you will, on how they'll be handled. There are some fatigue-based techniques such as lengthy questioning at all hours of the day and night, techniques designed to wear a subject down. Those things are regarded as fair game and will undoubtedly be used.
John, you said time will tell, and that's true, but there will be pressure on these interrogators, too, won't there, to get the information and get the trial going?
There is some time in the sense that what we need to see before there can be a trial is a structure for that trial, and that doesn't yet exist. So there is a reasonable amount of time. The highest priority information concerns the questions they've already asked him. Does he have any knowledge of impending attacks? That's the top priority. They've covered that ground already. He has denied direct knowledge of attacks. There have been some documents found on him that are leading U.S. military forces to individuals in and around Baghdad that may be involved in the insurgency. The initial evidence is that he was not running the insurgency. Yes, there is a need to move fairly quickly to sort of empty his mind, if you will, in terms of what he may know or what he may be willing to admit in connection with the war crimes. And the war crimes will not be a simple case to present, but you would have to say that when you see mass graves, when you consider that he has already made some statements to members of the Iraqi Governing Council about how these were people who got what they deserved and so forth, the evidence regarding the gassing of Kurdish minorities back in the 1980s, there's a large volume of evidence of human rights abuses that will be brought to bear.
John, just to finish up, will the CIA have in its quiver, if you will, the experience of other, particularly al-Qaeda suspects who've been arrested in recent months? Will that be a track record they'll be bringing to the interrogation of Saddam?
No question about it. And the CIA, the reason the CIA is taking the lead role is that they are the experts at long-term interrogation as opposed to a law enforcement questioning, which might be done in a matter of days or even just hours, or of a military interrogation, which is focused strictly on operational questions. The CIA, they're the experts at the long-term techniques, and they've been doing that, of course, for decades, but they've been doing it intensely ever since 9/11 and more recently with the invasion of Iraq and the handling of al-Qaeda and Iraqi captives.
John Diamond covers intelligence for USA Today. He spoke to us from Washington. John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And as always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your name, phone number, and the town where you live.
You can write us as well to Here and Now, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215.
And just ahead, the 100th anniversary of the first flight, the Triumph, and many trials of the Wright brothers.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
100 years ago today, December 17th, 1903, Orville and Wilbur Wright made their famous first flight at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, and changed history and then soared off into the sunset. Famous, then rich, right? Well, actually, it turns out they hit plenty of bumpy air after that flight. Lane Wallace writes for Flying Magazine and joins us now on the line from California. Lane, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
What exactly did the Wright brothers invent?
They made a couple of big breakthrough discoveries that made the airplane possible. The biggest of those was, and this is what they patented, was the concept of three-axis control. They were the first ones to understand and figure out that in order to make an airplane controllable in flight, you had to make it not only go up and down and left and right, but you also had to find a way to allow the wings to bank or roll. When an airplane turns, you'll notice one wing goes up, one goes down. That's what allows it to be stable and controllable in flight. That concept is essential in order to make an airplane fly.
Remind us just briefly who they were.
The Wright brothers were two bicycle mechanics, sons of a very strict Christian bishop who were brought up in Dayton, Ohio. They became very, very impassionately interested in aviation in 1899. They spent actually 4 years developing the airplane. Their approach to the airplane was as rigorous as any scientist or researcher today, and that is what made them successful.
Now, by 1905, just 2 years after that first flight, Orville and Wilbur had stopped flying, right? And they didn't fly again.
There are two things that are very important to remember about the Wright brothers. And one is that, interestingly enough, the same personality traits that made them able to be successful in inventing the airplane, their stubbornness, their dedication, their very analytical, rational worldview, were the same traits that worked against them after they had invented the airplane in their efforts to market it and to do anything with it. They spent 2 years between 1903 and 1905 developing a practical, marketable product. And then, just like you would expect, they took that product and locked it in a shed and refused to demonstrate it or fly it after that.
What was that all about?
A little counterintuitive.
Yeah.
But there were four reasons they did that. And the first one was that they were very concerned about protecting their ideas, and with good reason. The Wright brothers flew their airplane for the first time December 17, 1903. They received their first letter threatening legal action if they didn't share credit and profits from their invention by Christmas Day of 1903, which was 8 days later. So they really did have legitimate cause to be concerned about protecting their ideas. So that was number one. Number two, in 1906, they did get a patent awarded, so one would think they then could have demonstrated it. But what they wanted was they didn't want to sell airplanes. They wanted to sell the prototype and all the secrets that had made it possible to one customer who would then pay them enough that they could devote their lives to research.
Mm-hmm.
That never happened. But their desire for that is part of the reason that they didn't want to demonstrate the airplane. They wanted to keep those secrets under wraps.
They tried to negotiate a contract with the U.S. government, didn't they?
They did.
Why didn't that work out?
Well, two reasons. One, was that the government didn't see a screaming need for an airplane in 1905, 6, 7, and 8. The U.S. did not consider itself close to war or needing an airplane for military purposes. Mm-hmm. Europe was more interested in putting money into the airplane, and European governments did, in fact, put much more money into airplane development. But that was one thing. The second thing was that the Wright brothers had some very strict stipulations for a contract with the U.S. government. They wanted $250,000 for the airplane and all its secrets. But more importantly, the government had to sign a purchase agreement and put a down payment in escrow before they would demonstrate the airplane. What they didn't understand was just how much skepticism still existed in the world for flight. To the Wright brothers, they were sons of a Christian bishop. Their word was their bond. If they said they'd invented something, then that should be good enough for anyone. From their perspective, this made sense. They were insulted that someone would need a demonstration. From the U.S. government's perspective, they had a number of people claiming to have invented an airplane when they'd done nothing of the kind. So the government was not really inclined to put money in an escrow account and sign a purchase agreement for a flying machine they had never seen fly.
I see.
From the start, the Wrights ended up, in trying to protect their patent of this three-axis control, they ended up putting most of their energy from 1906 through 1917 into fighting patent wars in court instead of research and development for their airplane concepts. The biggest one of those wars was with a man called Glenn Curtiss. When he sold his first airplane in 1909, they sued, and the fights went on until 1917. They became very bitter and personal in 1912 because Wilbur Wright, who had a frail constitution to start with, developed typhoid fever and died. Orville always blamed Glenn Curtiss for this because he said it was the fights in court with Curtiss that had weakened his brother and made him susceptible to the disease. So after 1912, it was very bitter, very personal, and it really didn't get resolved until the U.S. was on the brink of war in 1917.
When everyone just had to pull together.
The U.S. government stepped in and said, we've got a war looming. We need airplanes. Yeah. They took the Curtiss Company, the Wright Company. They said, here's $2 million for you. Here's $2 million for you. Stop it.
Yeah.
Go build airplanes. And so, first of all, that was the first real investment of money the U.S. government had made in aviation. Second thing was, it put an end to the patent wars.
So just to finish up, Lane, what became of Orville?
Orville Wright sold the Wright Company in 1915. The good news is that made him a very wealthy man.
Oh.
The sale of the company really did make him money. However, what he really wanted was credit for inventing the airplane. And he fought that battle with all sorts of other people, including the Smithsonian Institution, until his death in 1948. The Smithsonian, for a variety of reasons, did not acknowledge the Wright brothers as the inventors of the airplane until 1942, which is why the Wright flyer that hangs in the Smithsonian today did not hang there until 1948, after Orville's death, when he said it could come back to the Smithsonian. But he wanted acknowledgement first of their accomplishment. The money was secondary to him. He wanted credit, and he fought long battles for most of his life to get that credit.
Lane Wallace, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the answer to a longtime border dispute between Honduras and El Salvador may lie in a stack of 18th century documents.
And why do Canada and the UK have flu vaccine to spare while U.S. public health officials are scrambling? That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, an anti-Howard Dean attack ad hits the airwaves.
But Howard Dean has no military or foreign policy experience.
And it's produced by fellow Democrats.
The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the Kings, opens today. It's celebrated at a gathering of Tolkien faithful.
There were a lot of elf princesses, just more elf princesses per square foot than anywhere else in the world. But there was also Nazgul riding the escalators up and down.
Oh, goodness.
There were ents, a person wearing stilts to be 14 feet tall, dressed as an ent.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Steve Brown. A reenactment of the Wright brothers' first flight is expected this hour in North Carolina. The event planned for earlier today was delayed by rain. President Bush made a quick visit to the Kill Devil Hill site, then flew away in Air Force One, which tipped its wing to the crowd that gathered to commemorate the brothers' first flight 100 years ago today. The biracial daughter of the late Senator Strom Thurmond is speaking out. 78-year-old Essie Mae Williams said she kept silent about being Thurmond's out-of-wedlock daughter because she didn't want to hurt his career.
At this juncture in my life, I am looking for closure. I am not bitter. I am not angry. In fact, there's a great sense of peace that has come over me in the past year.
Williams says her mother became pregnant at 16 while serving as Thurmond's maid. Thurmond's family says it has no reason to doubt Williams' claims. President Bush's parents say they were overjoyed to hear that Saddam Hussein was captured. This according to President Bush Sr. in his first public remarks about the arrest. The former president said the capture was a blessing for the country. He did mention, however, that he feels uncomfortable talking about events in his son's administration. U.S. troops have detained at least a dozen people in a pre-dawn raid in the tense town of Samarra, Iraq. Soldiers were backed by attack helicopters and military vehicles in the effort aimed at stopping an insurgency in the area. Jury deliberations are underway in the murder trial of Lee Malvo. The Virginia jury is to decide if Malvo was an active partner in last year's Washington area sniper shootings or a brainwashed partner. Prosecutors contend Malvo knew what he was doing. Malvo's attorney told the jurors that the 18-year-old was, quote, the last victim of John Mohammed. French President Jacques Chirac has asked France's parliament to pass a law banning Islamic headscarves and other religious insignia in public schools. This despite cries that the move will stigmatize France's 5 million Muslims. Chirac says he also wants to open the way for businesses to impose the same ban, warning that fanaticism is gaining ground in France. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are down. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 16 points at 10,114. The NASDAQ is down 7 points at 1918. And the S&P 500 is down 2 points at 1070. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
A controversial new ad attacking Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean is airing in New Hampshire and South Carolina. As the camera zooms in on a picture of Osama bin Laden, the phrases dangerous world and no experience flash on screen. The ad ends with this statement.
And Howard Dean just cannot compete with George Bush on foreign policy. It's time for Democrats to think about that. and think about it now.
It would, at first glance, appear to be the work of Dean's rival Republicans. But the group that produced the ad, the newly formed Americans for Jobs, Healthcare, and Progressive Values, is run by Democrats with former ties to other campaigns and unknown backers who are not required by law to identify themselves until next month after the New Hampshire primary. Richard Gephardt denies any connection to the ads, but union leaders who have endorsed him and given money for ads say these ads were not what they bargained for. Rick Sloan is spokesperson for the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers.
I think the ads are despicable, and if I had my way, I would ask to have our money returned.
In a moment, we'll talk about the legal campaign finance loophole that allows these kinds of attack ads. But first, joining us on the line is Robert Gibbs. He's a spokesperson for Americans for Jobs, Healthcare, and Progressive Values. Robert, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Well, I'm fine, but how are you? You have been roundly criticized for using Osama bin Laden's face in this ad. The New York Times in an editorial called it grand guignol tactics. They're referring to the terrifying theater in Paris that made people pass out. What was your thinking behind creating the ad?
Well, I think if anybody watches the entirety of the ad, they'll understand that the issue that is up for discussion is the national security and foreign policy experience of candidates in this race. I don't think anybody that's watched the news in the last few weeks or few days could quibble with the fact that we live in a very dangerous world, and experience is a very important issue in the current process that's going on right now.
Well, in fact, the Times does go on to say that, you know, the issue at hand is a legitimate one and the criticism is a legitimate one to make. But the use of Osama bin Laden, I mean, did you goof with it? You have been so roundly criticized. Even Gephardt's campaign is saying if these people thought they were helping us by criticizing Dean, they're not, because some of the mud seems to have splashed on him.
Well, understand, this is an independent political organization, not affiliated with a campaign or a political committee. This is not intended to help anybody. This is intended, as an issue ad is, to bring into discussion and into the political discourse issues that are important in this process. I believe that no one would doubt that foreign policy and national security is certainly an important issue in this process.
But what do you do about the perceptions? Yours is a small organization. David Jones, who's the treasurer, is a former treasurer for Representative Gephardt. You yourself worked for the Kerry campaign. There's a perception that a few guys left other Democratic campaigns to go off and form this group that it can only legally attack in the way that you did because you're not affiliated with a campaign.
Well, I think anybody that's paid attention to the staffing news of presidential campaigns would understand that I left the Kerry campaign several weeks ago in a senior staff shakeup where I resigned from the campaign. The ad is not affiliated with any political organization, and the ads are certainly based entirely on fact and comply with the new campaign finance reform laws that the House and Senate passed and the president signed last year. The date that this organization has to report its donors to the IRS and to the FEC is at the end of January. The group will comply with every part of campaign finance law by disclosing those donors at that date.
Why not do it, just to deflect some of the criticism?
Well, I don't. Look, I think it's criticism that's being brought up by people that
like me
that may feel uncomfortable with the ad. And we intend to comply with every aspect of federal campaign finance law as it is prescribed.
Well, but again, the question is, you know, since there's so much criticism, why not do it and get it off the shelf as a topic?
I don't think it's a topic.
Well, Robert Gibbs, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Robert Gibbs, spokesperson for Americans for Jobs, Healthcare, and Progressive Values, the producers of the Osama bin Laden, Howard Dean ad. We turn now to Norman Ornstein. He's resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and an expert on campaign finance reform. Norman, your reaction to the ad?
Well, I don't like the ad at all. At the same time, I mean, I think we can criticize the ad harshly. That's part of a public debate. If we knew exactly who was putting on this ad, then they could suffer the consequences if there's a backlash. What's missing here at this point is having a firm sense of who's behind this.
Well, and as Robert Gibbs points out, he's doing nothing illegal. Let's remind people how these 527s, they're called, these groups like Americans for Jobs, Healthcare, and Progressive Values, how do they function? They can't be affiliated with a politician, correct?
No, they can't. And, of course, they're called 527s because this is an entity that exists under Section 527 of the Internal Revenue Code. It's a political organization that can operate and receive funding from a lot of different sources, like unions, corporations, individuals. It has to act independently of candidates. One of the questions here is whether this organization is acting legitimately independent of candidates. Now, under the new campaign law, they can raise money, they can spend this kind of money on ads, but once they get within these windows of being 30 days before a primary or 60 days before a general election, their ads have to, because they're ads that target particular candidates and focus on candidates in areas where there are elections, those are just like campaign ads. It's electioneering, and you have to operate under the same rules that candidates and parties operate under, where you have some limits on the money that can be used, and you can't use the corporate or union money.
But Norm, let me ask you, there might be people saying, well, whatever happened to campaign finance reform? These stealth groups mean that if somebody wants to avoid the limit on giving to a candidate, you can just go set up your own group. I'm thinking of the Republicans for Clean Air that two brothers set up to support George Bush, and they spent millions of dollars in ads supporting him, but they were a separate entity. So where's the reform?
Well, look, the reform is not going to suddenly magically create a Garden of Eden in the campaign system. One area of reform here is that these ads now are very consciously being run outside that 30-day window, and it makes a real difference when ads are very close to the election. Because of the nature of this ad, it's backfired on this group. They're getting a lot of attention that, frankly, they don't want. This is if there was any kind of even wink and nod coordination with, say, the Gephardt campaign, certainly Congressman Gephardt, who's been subject to some tough editorials on this issue in the Washington Post, for example, is finding that it's not a particularly pleasant experience. The authors of the law were under no illusion that this was a one-time cure-all for problems in the campaign system. It puts some broad boundaries around behavior, and everybody's going to try to evade it, and you're going to have to come back to it in a matter of several years.
Well, Norm, thank you.
Sure.
Norm Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and expert on campaign finance reform.
Still to come, foie gras, anyone? Gourmet food online. And the third and final installment of Lord of the Rings is now on the big screen.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Nothing sweeter this time of year than the look of a child's face marveling at some new toy. But nothing may be more necessary for whoever gave the gift than a pair of industrial-strength earplugs. In a new study, 9 of 11 kids' toys that the nonprofit Sight and Hearing Association chose to test were found to be louder than the average chainsaw. We're joined now by Julie Sylvester, spokeswoman for the Sight and Hearing Association. She joins us from Blaine, Minnesota. Hi, Julie.
Hello.
Well, Julie, your organization did the study. What are they selling, kids? Hand grenades?
I don't believe their intention is to do that, but because there are no regulations currently that exist regarding the loudness of toys, what toy manufacturers are doing nowadays is making toys that have lots of sound and lights on them, which is great, but a lot of these toys are too loud.
Now, how did you conduct your study?
Well, basically, our process is fairly simple. I go into the stores, go into various toy stores. I take a sound level meter with me. If I find a toy that I believe is at a certain level, we purchase them, and then I take those toys to the University of Minnesota and have them tested in a soundproof booth, again, with a sound level meter, and we do them at two different measurements. The first is directly at the speaker of the toy, and the second measurement is at 12 inches from the toy, kind of your average child's arm length.
So what kind of toys are we talking about that turned out to be as loud as a chainsaw?
Well, believe it or not, our top offender this year was a book. It's called Barney Songs, and it is actually the recommended age group for it is 18 months plus.
Huh.
And you press the buttons on the side, and it plays cute little songs, But in our test directly at the speaker, that measured out to be 115 decibels, which is very similar to potentially a jet ski. I give you kind of a time frame. In around 15 minutes, you can pose potential risk to your hearing at that level. Our second toy, or our top offender this year, was the Home Depot has a line of toys that are sold in toy stores called, this one was the Workman screwdriver. So it kind of simulates what an electric screwdriver might be. Okay. And it turned out to be 112 decibels directly at the speaker,
wow,
which is, you know, just 3 decibels lower than the songbook. Some of the other toys are musical-type toys, the CNC Barnyard Banjo. We also had the Funyear's Music Sing-Along Electronic Guitar. Both of those were 109, 110 decibels.
Are there any rules or regulations surrounding this, not to mention, bad as it may be, for parents who may run screaming from the room? What about the kids? I mean, is there no limit to how loud a toy can be?
There actually isn't. The last kind of standard I saw was from the American Society of Testing Materials, and it was around 138 or so decibels, 25 centimeters from the toy. So really, there is nothing that addresses the loudness of toys. You know, in the workplace setting, if you take OSHA guidelines, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration guidelines, they set the workplace noise levels at 85 decibels for 8 hours. So these toys are
exceeding OSHA regulations, these toys.
Right. All of these toys were 98 decibels and above. But you also have to look at not only the intensity, but how long the exposure to that noise is. So most kids will not be playing with one single toy for 8 hours at a time or 4 hours.
Julie Sylvester is spokeswoman for the nonprofit Sight and Hearing Association. She's been testing loud toys this holiday season. Julie, thanks very much.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
One complaint about giving gifts at the holidays is that all that new stuff can just clutter up your life. Well, one way around that might be really good food, gourmet food, which you eat and then it's gone. Joining us in the studio with his suggestions for the gift of food is Here and Now food guru, Scott Haas. Scott, welcome.
Thanks, Bill.
Scott, what do you got for us?
Well, I brought in some of my favorite food items. I literally buy all of my food, with the exception of fresh vegetables, fresh fruit, and a few other things over the internet. And I brought in some wonderful cookies and a brownie from a company called Jeff and Drew's. This brownie is satanic because it weighs, I'd say, about a quarter pound. It's studded with beautiful chocolate chips. They almost look like BBs embedded in this big, gooey mass of chocolate. And there's some beautiful salmon. There's
Well, let's stop right there. How does salmon arrive fresh and over through the mails, as it were?
It's Federal Express. Federal Express, UPS, Airborne Express.
So it's there the next day.
It's there the next day.
That's what they say.
One of the things about all these companies, I mean, for example, there's this wonderful steak company called Lobel's, truly the best steak I've ever had in my life, that they will say, if you're not going to be there, we won't deliver. You need to be absolutely sure that someone will be there to receive the package.
Lobel's is in New York on Madison Avenue, did you say?
They're based in New York, but they ship nationwide. And the great thing about any of these products is that there's nothing wrong with buying a gift basket. I mean, the gift baskets that are available at all sorts of places, like at Zabar's or Citarella or Formaggio Kitchen based in Cambridge, they're all terrific. But sometimes you end up getting, you know, pepper-flavored jelly or some crackers you don't like or a particular kind of cheese you don't like. So you can cherry pick from hundreds of sites, buy lots of different things, and make your own baskets.
Well, let's cherry pick among your favorites and give people kind of a way to begin from the hundreds of possibilities out there.
Well, I was in San Francisco in September, and I went to an open-air farmer's market, and I found these great dried apricots. The reason why dried fruit in California is so much better than other places is because they don't use discarded or rough fruit for making the dried fruit. This is as fresh as the fruit that you're going to get.
Bella Viva Orchards.
Yeah, it's a family-owned place. I sent them an email. I found their website, and I get about 15 pounds of this, you know, every 2 or 3 months.
Beautiful. And, of course, all this will be on our website for folks who want to check it out. What else you got? I see a bottle of wine.
Now, depending on where you live, one of the idiosyncratic things about the end of Prohibition is that each state has its own regulations about delivery of wine. A lot of websites that you'll go onto will offer beautiful wine that the owners of the website have found in France, Italy, elsewhere. But you have to be sure that you can receive it in your estate. In fact, many places they will not deliver to. So before you order the wine, make sure that you can.
Is there any advantage or disadvantage price-wise?
For the dried fruit, for sure, because you're competing with everybody else on the web. Also, a lot of these sites, like Molinari or Jameson Farms, this great lamb, is that they are wholesale purveyors to restaurants. So they're not giving you the wholesale price, but it's darn close.
David Burke, gourmet cheesecake.
Yeah, that's kind of funny. This is a chef based in New York, and he makes a variety of different kinds of lollipops. But these are cheesecake lollipops. He also makes foie gras lollipops.
You did say cheesecake lollipops.
Cheesecake lollipops, and they're fun. They're delicious. What intrigues me about each one of these sites also, in addition to the fact that I don't have to leave my house and I can go shopping, is that these are small businesses. They operate small sites based on very, very idiosyncratic points of view.
Now, Scott, you insist that you're doing most of your food shopping over the internet. Are you very unusual, or is this catching on?
Well, according to the New York Times 2 weeks ago, it's catching on. I don't know exactly why it's catching on. I think it's catching on because it's very convenient. The other thing, too, is the products you're getting, frankly, are, unless you're living in a major metropolitan area, they often are superior to what you can get at your local grocery store.
Here and now, foodie Scott Haas joined us on Food Through the Internet. Thanks very much indeed, Scott.
Thank you, Bill.
For more information on Scott's picks, go to our website, here-now.org.
Today is the day, the culmination of a year-long wait to see how the battle against evil ends. Well, if you read the book, you already know, but tension is still high because the third movie in the Tolkien Lord of the Rings trilogy, The Return of the King, is here.
I see in your eyes the same fear that would take the heart of me. A day may come when the courage of man fails, when we forsake our friends and break all bonds of fellowship. But it is not this day. We fight!
Oh, someone revive my 13-year-old niece, Dylan, who I'm sure has just fainted. She and others of the most dedicated fans have probably already seen the film at least once. The movie opened at midnight in many cities to prevent complete emotional collapse of those fans who couldn't wait another minute. Michael Drought is well acquainted with Tolkien and his legion of fans. Drought is a Tolkien scholar and teaches medieval literature at Wheaton College, where attendance has boomed since the first two films came out. Michael Drought joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
And you know what we were just listening to. Was that the king returning? You've seen the film.
That was the king who returns. That was Aragorn, who's the rightful king of the country of Gondor. And that's him rallying the troops for the final climactic battle against evil.
Oh, boy. Just tell us. I mean, this is not a film review, but like it?
I think it's the best of the three films by quite a long shot.
Someone revive my niece again. Okay, you were just at a gathering of Tolkien fans. What happens there?
This was called the Gathering of the Fellowship, the largest gathering of Tolkien fans in North America. There were 2,000 people there. About 75% of them were in full costume.
What does that mean? Wait, what? Flowing robes, I'm thinking.
Beautiful flow. There were a lot of elf princesses, just more elf princesses per square foot than anywhere else in the world. But there was also Nazgul riding the escalators up and down.
Oh, goodness.
There were Ents, a 14-foot tall person, a person wearing stilts to be 14 feet tall, dressed as an Ent. There were hobbits
galore. What's an Ent again? Tell.
Those are the talking trees.
Oh, sure.
There were hobbits galore. There was a giant Sauron, the Dark Lord, who was clanking around in full body armor. It was most impressive. You know, I work on Tolkien professionally. I also am a medievalist. I work on Beowulf. But there are people there who know so much more than me. And I've read The Lord of the Rings probably 40 times since my father read it to me when I was 4 years old. There are people there who can write fluent Elvish and do Elvish calligraphy.
Elvish. Let's discuss this. There are websites where you can learn the language of the Tolkien characters, including Elvish, the language of the elves.
And there's actually two Elvish languages.
Oh, boy.
He invented multiple ones, but the two that are really fleshed out are one is called Quenya, which is High Elven, which you only hear a tiny bit of, and the other is Sindarin, which is the more common elf speech. And Quenya was based on the phonology of Finnish, so it has a lot of vowel harmony, like the one poem, Namarie, is I lori lasi liirtanen, kind of that it sounds like Finnish. And then the Sindarin is much more based on the phonology of Welsh. So you have things like Elbereth gilthoniel silvirin penemiriel.
What does that mean?
It's kind of like a prayer or a hymn to the kind of quasi-goddess Elbereth, who's the goddess of the stars and the most beloved of the elves.
Well, for those who have been praying for this movie to come, Ty Burr in the Boston Globe Review, first of all, he said that fans have to have buns of steel to sit through the movie because it's so long, but it's well worth the sit and the wait. And just a little bit of the plot summation. Now that the armies of men have won the day at Helm's Deep and Treebeard's Ents have brought down Saruman's tower, Gandalf and Pippin ride to the city of Minas Tirith in Gondor to warn the surly steward Denethor of the approach of Sauron's orcs. It is so complicated.
It is very complicated, and they simplified it radically for the film version. There's a lot more complexity, actually, in the book, and some of it that can be hard to follow. But I think that's what sets The Lord of the Rings apart from everything else, is that richness and integrity, I think, that attracts the fans to it, even when Hollywood has had to simplify it in some ways.
What are some of the things that you think fans of the book are going to immediately miss in the movie?
Saruman, the evil wizard, is not there at all.
Ah.
He's been completely cut out. They just go to his tower and look at the tower and then ride off. And I think the worst thing about the movie is that Denethor, who's a very complex character, a very King Lear-like character in the books, becomes a kind of stock, gibbering villain.
Do they have those, like, marching elephant-y things?
Yes, the giant killer elephants are there in what is, I think, got to be the best special effects sequence ever. It's a 6,000-horse cavalry charge with giant death elephants and people climbing on the death elephants and shooting arrows and leaping around, and you've never seen anything like it on screen.
Well, Michael, thank you. And watch out for the stampede at the movie theaters today. Michael Drought, a Tolkien scholar and associate professor of English at Wheaton College in Massachusetts.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories Here and Now.
Why do Canada and the UK have flu vaccine to spare while U.S. public health officials are scrambling?
And Canada's Jane Sibbery lends her angelic voice to the hymns of Handel and Bach.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.